I'm going to let you into a couple of trade secrets. Not every writer can write. I know this all too well because I've interviewed countless thousands of writers from every possible category over the last 30-odd years. Many of their books, even after heavy and substantial editing, are still, God, they're hard work. And sometimes some quite famous Australian books were written almost entirely by the editor. Fortunately, today's guest is not one of those. He is, in fact, a terrific stylist. What's Tom Keneally say about him? Dazzlingly elegant. Perfectly, perfectly true. I am about to introduce you to Don Watson. His collected writings are called There It Is Again. I'll ask him about the title shortly. But let the record show that, yes, Don is famously a speechwriter for Keating. He was an academic historian. He's written feature films. He wrote comedy for Max Gillies. Heavens, on and on it goes. But Donald has this great gift for putting words so beautifully on the page that I almost actively resent him. Ladies and gentlemen, Don Watson. I'm going to hold the book up to the microphone so all the listeners can see it. It's got vertical strips. Don thinks they're Venetian blinds, and he says he hates vertical Venetians. I think, in fact, it symbolises shredding. Why don't you know? You're the bloody author.
I think you're right. I think it's a shredder. All along I've thought they're vertical Venetians. But
did the shredding go far enough?
No, but I have a shredder in my head forever because I used to hear it in Parliament House at the end of every question time. I'd see him go past in a blur and I'd hear the shredder next door.
Was it a shredder that did it that way or a shredder that did it both ways?
I never looked.
No, okay. Yeah. The title, There It Is Again, what's that about?
I think it's about the last one. There is the only one that's never been published. But it's the notion that really you've got to see it twice before you believe it. And I said it in a cave, early man, and I hear a noise, as we all do. Or I set myself in bed as a child with the wind whistling up the gully, and you hear a noise and you think, that could be anything, and you listen, and it's the second time you've got to decide whether to panic or hide or something. But it basically, it's a sort of, you know, it's crass anthropology, thinking that if you, crap anthropology might be another way of putting it, that we progress by this ability to hear something, to establish patterns. You'd know this because you know all about science, that it's by establishing patterns that we work out how to survive, really.
There is, of course, every reason for panic at the moment with what we're hearing. It's not necessarily the most chaotic time in Australian political history. We had a more rapid turnover in prime ministers just after Federation. But in our lifetime, it seems to be about the worst.
It does. It's I don't know whether it's a function of our age or, you know, the reality, but it hasn't felt, since Howard went, it hasn't felt as if we actually have had politics with any stability at all. I mean, in fact, you keep thinking it's a sort of interregnum and it'll change and we'll get back into rhythm and everything will be fine, but this may be the way politics is now always going to be. And I think it's partly because both parties have lost their roots in whatever it was they once had their roots in. You know, the Liberal Party is now a bunch of, you know, a few wets and a lot of quite bizarre dries. The Labor Party's roots in the unions are sort of bizarre with, you know, powerful union influence, but not only 12% of Australians are unionised. So I think it's sort of inevitable. And the politicians don't seem any longer to have, you know, like if you take Hawke and Howard as examples. Now, Hawke, the great conciliator, but you always, he liked his friendships with business more than any other friendships. But you always knew that, you know, Hawke's fangs were Labor back here. You know, there were, you know, he was of a certain caste, and Howard was the same. You know, he would pretend to be a sort of everyman, but really he was a deep-dyed lip. I don't think any longer that you can say that about anybody. I don't think anyone can explain the Liberal Party at the moment. I mean, if anyone can explain Tony Abbott, they should put their hand up now.
Because anyone, can anyone explain Tony Abbott? No hands are going up here.
Whereas, I mean, I think you can probably explain the Turnbull. You can't. What Tony Abbott's doing just seems to me. And is there, if you open, you know, how we used to read newspapers, you now open the Fairfax website and or any website, and you'll see Tony Abbott three or four times every day. There he is. There's a little picture of him. He said this. He said this. He said this. He's got nothing to do with anything. And yet there he is. That's the news. What Tony Abbott said today. But he now runs Australia. He runs the Australian political debate in a way. I can't figure why. On the other hand, the debate is now interrupted by all sorts of things. In the taxi on the way to the airport this morning, I was listening to the news on the station that was on the car radio, and it's one of the items high up in the news was what happened on The Bachelor last night.
Exactly.
That was what is happening on TV, on shows on TV, becomes news.
Right. The Bachelor.
It's a show. It's a TV show. Yeah. I haven't seen it. I think it's a reality show.
Yes. Okay, I once saw an episode of The Apprentice with a young bloke called Donald Trump in it. I thought he showed promise.
Yeah, well, so did he. And that's another story.
Should there be any historians left to write it? This is from an essay called What Will History Make of Us? Should there be any historians left to write it, history might decide that ours was the age when Australians began to live as tropical fish do of each other, aware only of what they need and what threatens them, changing colour with their emotions, lacking any sense of provenance or fate or life on either side of the moment in which they live. They were free of all faiths, the historians might say. They gave up on collective ideals, history and language all at once. And they fashioned their lives according to their self-interest and their vanity. God, you sound like a grumpy old bugger.
Yeah. Yeah, I am. Well, I think that's true. I mean, I've done this stuff on language for years now. I grew out of working with the public service, first in John Cain's office and then in
Peter's office. You were a speechwriter for John, weren't you?
I was, yes, yeah. on a sort of consultancy sort of basis. And well, to give you an example, the first speech I ever wrote was the La Trobe lecture on education, the Charles Joseph La Trobe lecture for John Cain. And the brief came up from the department, and after an hour of looking at it, I thought, I'm not up to this job, I'm not smart enough, I can't do it. I don't understand any of this. But I rang them, before resigning immediately, I rang the department and said, I don't understand this. What is it? And they said, well, we don't know, this is just what we always write. And it was just so weighed down with platitudes and slogans and messages and access and equity. That was the buzz phrase of the time, access and equity, over and over again. So I started from scratch, and that became my habit as a speechwriter, to really ask the department for information, but not for anything. Don't put anything in words, you know. And since then, I think what's happened is that we've reduced the world to sort of dot points. And when you do that, when you take sentences out of the way we think, you take the ability to think in certain ways away from us as well. And that, in a way, is about... It's really about the management revolution, or the information age, if you like, or the knowledge economy. If you don't have a living language, well, then you lose just about everything. And I think most people in employment these days are speaking this language without meaning. You know, there have always been concerns about the language being undermined, you know, Sam Johnson and Ed Orwell and the rest. But that was sort of, it was formal English that was falling apart at various times, and grammarians, you know, would hurry to fix it. But this attacks the vernacular, everything. There's no invention in language now in the working lives of people. And the universities have disgracefully abandoned it as well. Abandoned their role as protecting the heritage of language and much else. History's gone, literature's largely gone. See, here I go again, getting miserable.
You're among friends, we're all miserable here.
Well, when I went to... if anyone had told me when I went to university in the late 1960s that the history department of 40 people would be reduced to maybe half a dozen, that history departments would go, literature departments would go, philosophy departments would go, all those... And we sort of have given up this heritage.
But what has philosophy ever done for us, for heaven's sake?
Oh, absolutely.
You can't get a job with a philosophy degree.
Absolutely, that's right. I know. I can see the sense of what they're doing, but it just makes me miserable. Not that I really was a star in philosophy. I read it better now. But
when did you discover words, or when did they discover you? Because you were born in the bush. We're not meant to talk much up here.
No, well, that might be why I discovered them, you know, that they were, and they, people didn't talk much. I think walking around watercourses in heavy rain in South Gippsland, you know, getting a cow into a bale, you know.
Did you go to the local municipal library and get William books out?
No, Eagles? I didn't. We had a few books, Steel Rudd, you know.
That's Kevin's father.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. We read Steel Rudd a lot because we came from selections. But Queensland selections and Gippsland selections are rather different, but certain attitudes were the same. And we laughed and laughed. And that doesn't matter how many times we read Cranky Jack, we laughed. It still makes me laugh. We didn't read much at all, but the Bible sort of infiltrated... In a way, I read the Bible when I was about 11, the New Testament. I had a religious phase. It lasted as long as it took me to read the New Testament. I think I picked up some of that sort of King James, you know, that sort of stuff, which real language, you know, real English derives from. Those sort of beautiful cadences and a bit of horror. Not much in the New Testament, but I graduated to the old. I got to love literature at high school, read a lot. I don't know how it ended up the way it did.
When did you start writing, Don?
As an historian, I wrote a PhD when I was... I did my PhD on Brian Fitzpatrick, who
yes,
you knew.
And
I picked up some of his stuff too, I think. He was a bit of a... Oh, he was dead by the time I wrote about him, but I got, you know, he was a bit of a mentor internally.
Well, at some point in your life, you put enough words on paper to get you a job working for John Cain, a thoroughly decent, straight man in Australian politics. And this, although this is written a little later, you did have a job, as a political advisor. So let me read this. A political advisor, writes Don Watson in his new compilation, there it is again, a political advisor is a kind of funnel, and should be wide at one end and narrow at the other. The wide end is to take in information from every imaginable source, the narrow end to fit snugly in the Prime Minister's ear. The wide end is permanently open to the media, the public service, the polls, other ministers and their staff, the caucus, the party secretariat, and the rank and file, wives and friends, eccentrics, critics, lobbies, political geniuses and idiots alike. The narrow end discharges the decoction when it is all boiled down, one droplet at a time, for preference, or so he can quietly absorb it. It is a sure sign of the novice that he sprays his advice all over the place. Inside the funnel, of course, there must be a filter. So you found yourself as a filter with a funnel.
Yeah, it took a while to learn the art, but I did. I don't know how that happened, really, but Paul and I got on very well, extremely well.
That Keating he's talking about,
yeah,
who I hadn't mentioned yet, but...
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to bring it up.
Stuck into Keating shortly.
It's odd that I should, really, but... Yeah. But I was no advisor to John Cain, so... I mean, the life of a political officer is a really... It's very intense. I still think about it probably once a week at least. it creeps into my mind because it was such an intense experience. It may be just that it was the Keating office, I don't know.
After saying nothing more in public and returning to Don's afterward, after saying nothing more in public for the best part of a decade, last year Keating wrote an article in which, co-opting to his case a remark alleged of Graham Freudenberg, and Keating charged me with breaking the contract.
The alleged contract is this idea that the speechwriter vanishes. It becomes the politician's speech, which is something I have always honoured. Of course it's Paul's speech. I mean, I think what a speechwriter does is he or she presents it as advice, but it's formally composed. And the politician, it becomes the politician's when he or she decides which bits he or she will use and which bits she'll discard. But there is nothing in the contract that a speechwriter signs which says, you know, your tongue will be drilled and you'll never speak again of what you've experienced.
There's a paradox in the quality of oratory, and that is that in this country we saw the ascendancy of a number of political figures, and I'd begin in my experience with Joe Bjelke Petersen, who made a virtue out of being incoherent. Hmm. It was almost as though people mistrusted eloquence. A politician like Gareth Evans, who was, you know, very good on the stump, was suspected, whereas a politician like Joe Bjelke Petersen was accepted. And we see the same thing, I guess, with Hanson and much of the One Nation crew.
Yes, well, Bjelke Petersen was... he made an art of it. I've always wondered whether it wasn't deliberate, because I remember, because I was working on the Gillies Report at the time, the Max Gillies TV show, some journalist once asked him if he'd seen the Gillies Report, because Max used to do a great Joe. And he said, and it's on my desk, but I haven't read it yet, he said. And he thought... You may be really dumb, or maybe you're not. Maybe you're sending us up here. But you see, Hawkey himself, he could butcher the language in the most extraordinary way. He'd go around in great circles and back, and you know, you'd find yourself cheering at the end because he'd escaped from this verbal trap. Yeah. And you couldn't remember a thing that he'd said, but he'd said, you know,
could sink into mud of his own making too. Goff was often a terrible speechifier.
I remember when Hawke had just become Prime Minister, being in a bar of all places, and there were a couple of barflies sitting there, and Hawke was saying, and I used to glaze over when he was talking in those days. On the one hand, you know, and on the other hand, you know, there are three reasons, and he goes to five and all that sort of stuff. And but one barfly looked at the other and said, "I like that bloke. He talks our talk, doesn't he?" And I thought, "He doesn't talk anything like you blokes at all." But they thought he did.
The voice of Don Watson at Scone Literary Festival earlier this month. Don's bestsellers include Reflections of a Bleeding Heart, Watson's Dictionary of Weasel Words, and American Journey. And you can look up his website, weaselwords.com.au, which documents the viral spread of management speak and the decline of public language. That's your lot for the week. Thanks to the team, EP, Gail Bosario, Sasha Fegan, Amrutha Slee, Anna Whitfield, Stan Corry, sound engineers Tim Jenkins, Jolan Camilleri, and here with me in Musselbrook, Mike Pritchard. Have a great weekend.